So we're here at Edinburgh Fringe just before it starts, and I'm joined by...
My name is Colin Alexander.
And...
David Leeson.
And Colin and David, we've just seen them at the Greenside launch playing Neville Chamberlain and...
Jack, his personal secretary.
Okay, and you're also here at the Fringe doing Mr. Laurel and Mr. Hardy as well,
yes,
which I know
yes,
was very
yes.
successful last year. But I want to focus on Chamberlain Peace in Our Time. Has that become more relevant with a world at war more than ever?
I think it probably is, yes. And important decisions that prime ministers take at a time and for better for worse can have huge impact not only on them personally but on their party and for Chamberlain certainly on his country. And so that's where we started with this. Chamberlain's often regarded in polls that we read anyway as one of our least effective, least popular prime ministers, and yet what he sought was peace. And he was followed by, often regarded as our most popular and effective prime minister in Churchill. And got me thinking, what was the difference between the two and where did Chamberlain go wrong? And that's where we began, really.
And also, you know, at the Fringe over the decades, you know, Churchill has been portrayed far more than Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. So what made you decide to pick on this character? Apart from you do look a bit like him.
Do I? I'll take that as a compliment, yes.
On, he's 60 years old.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, I didn't know too much about him. But I'm based in the Midlands, and Chamberlains are a big Birmingham family, and Chamberlain Square, Chamberlain Park, everything. Mainly his father, Joseph, was a very successful city father. Neville followed him as became Lord Mayor of Birmingham, and then Conservative MP, and swiftly got to success. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer within his first year in the House, and then PM when Baldwin steps aside. But more than that, I didn't know much about him, apart from his... broadcast to say that we were at war. So I just wanted to dig around, and he did have quite a number of successful policies, but all of that is forgotten in the fact that he ushered us into war. So it was mainly my own interest in him, and I found him fascinating, and I thought, yeah, maybe that day in September, what was going through his mind in Downing Street as he came down the stairs saying, any minute now I've got to stand in front of this microphone and declare war. So that's where we began with it.
And with so much source material, you know, in different forms, you know, how do you select, how do you distill that?
It was a tricky one, really, because we've only got 55 minutes here at the Fringe, but I wanted to have some music in as well, because what I found was the BBC that morning wanted to play fairly light and positive, uplifting music. But the country knew at 11:15 the Prime Minister was going to talk to them in the most somber manner. So that juxtaposition was very interesting for me. So Colin, my colleague, is a musician and a singer, so the play is interspersed with some music of the day. So that's where we started. I thought, well, I want to, first of all, what was going through Chamberlain's mind on that morning? Secondly, I wonder if he heard that light and positive music flowing through the airwaves just before he sat down.
And the writers like Dennis Potter have done that very successfully too, mixing that darkness with the music of the time.
Yeah, I definitely think so. The singing detective, that sort of idea, very, very interesting. And I also think the play has a great relevance. I just come back from doing a 7.5 month tour in South Korea, and it was most interesting, you know, to sit there. I mean, we were based in Seoul doing a musical for 3.5 months, to see the way that people are so blasé about 60 miles away. You've got this crazed dictator that you never know what's going to happen, and yet people are walking around not really being relevant to what was going on. I'm not saying the British people weren't at that time, but it's sometimes the decisions that people have got to make, and hopefully in this play you can see the kind of the pain and that he has to go through, and I think it's very relevant for where the world is right now.
Yeah. And playing Jack, have you developed any new perspectives on Chamberlain, who was in a kind of impossible position, wasn't he?
Yeah, and so even though I have the English accent and I was born in the UK, I live in the United States. So so it was interesting to come over and of course, I've done some research on Chamberlain, but just to see that the friendship that Jack has with Neville and his wife Anne, which becomes in the play as well, that he really wants to support him, and yet we'll be honest with him as well, especially with some of the things that Neville says, because if you come and see the show, he goes on a lot about Churchill this, Churchill that, and Jack is saying, well, but Neville, you're the man for today. He's the Prime Minister, and you're the man for today, and it's got to be your decisions.
And Jack actually stayed on and served Churchill as well. So he's a professional civil servant, but he also had a very noticeable affection for Chamberlain. I think a bit of a sympathy for the position Chamberlain found himself in.
How do you step into, dare I say, the suit, but also the skin of a character like that, from a theatre point of view?
It starts with reading. There are a number of biographies on Chamberlain, five or six that I read, some better than others. I think that was the start for me. I wandered around his place in Birmingham as well. So just getting a bit of the feel of him. I've always been interested in politics as well, and just the history of it particularly, and the Second World War history. So I knew some of him, and seen some films, read some books. So that was mainly it. And then listening to his speeches, there's no hint of Birmingham accent with his voice, from his public school upbringing and then living in London most of his life. So that's where it started for me. It was one word. He on the speech, the word imagine, he says imagine, which is a very strange way of saying imagine. And that for me started a little bit of where his characteristics. So you start with, yeah, he was in his 60s. So he says in the play he was almost ready for retirement and he becomes Prime Minister. So he's a bit older than me, stranger accent than me, I think, and probably had a bit of a shuffle. So those kind of characteristics I begin to look at, and then hopefully something happens with, you know, as you begin to perform it a bit more. And we've been rehearsing this for a number of weeks, and you know, we've found out more about him as we've gone on, really.
The impossible question: what do you think would have happened if he'd stayed in office?
Well, I think he honestly felt he was the right man, but the wrong time. He says politics is all about timing, and he said he was unfortunate. He should have followed Churchill. He reckons he would have been a great peacetime prime minister. I don't think he would have lasted long in wartime. He was the wrong man. There was that huge loss of life up in Norway soon after the war broadcast in September. That put paid to him, really. He was out of his depth in the war.
As we start the fringe, and without getting too much into the politics, we've got, you know, government ministers of Trump suddenly reaching out and saying, you know, you're not our enemy, North Korea.
Yeah, I know, interesting. And lots of shows about President Trump around, I noticed. So that would be interesting. And I think some people have said there are some shadows of Theresa May as well, and that she made a decision that maybe her, you know, people say her days are numbered because she made a wrong choice. Chamberlain made a wrong choice in his appeasement and his approaches to Hitler, and he knew after that his days were numbered. So there are some mirrors. Yeah.
Colin, can you take me into your rehearsal room and just give us a bit of a flavour of what that looks like?
Well, it was a really fun, really fun experience. Doing anything from scratch or a brand new piece, it's great to be able to delve in the characters, to find out more about them, to find out, because this is just a two-hander, two people, to find out their relationship. And I think that was interesting. We spent a lot of time wondering, how did Jack, my character, relate to Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, and vice versa. The points where there's in the play that are flash points. I mean, my character's not just always bowing down to him. He stands up to him in parts, and how would that have been as a private permanent secretary, you know, to say to the Prime Minister? And you'll hear it even in the little piece we just did now. He calls him Neville occasionally, which seems very disrespectful, but I think it was that friendship they had. So I think it's great to get into the characters, then find out how the music weaves into it, and then to find the highs and the lows. And when you're working with just the two of us, it's great to be able to do that because you have a lot more time. If you're working with a larger ensemble, as you know, the time's running away, it's hard to do that. But we had time to really, you know, chew and, you know, think about the characters.
A slightly sort of playful, mischievous question, but to mention that you also play Mr. Laurel and Mr. Hardy in another show. If somehow it were possible for all four of you to be in the same room as each other, how would they get on?
Well, that's our biggest fear, that
they may
we slip into the wrong script at some point. That's a very good question. Of course, Laurel was English by birth and a proud Brit, and a lot of his family were here, and he came over with Hardy. And I don't know, really. I only know that they both loved Great Britain, didn't they? And they came over here, toured the theatres, and our play is about them in the 50s, back end of their career, really, thinking that they were finished. And they filled the huge theatres every night, twice nightly, some of the biggest theatres in England, and their reflections on their time in England, which was 50s, so post-Chamberlain, were very, very strong and positive. They did some to the war effort work back in the States.
Yeah, they did. We did a little bit of research, and they did do help with the war bond effort in the United States, Laurel and Hardy. I mean, they were a little bit on the downside of their career at that point, but they did help. I mean, we tried to look into that just to see the connection between the two shows.
In their canon, you know, they are peacemakers that constantly get into conflict.
They are indeed, yeah. They are, yeah. And I think in troubled times, they certainly brought a lot of laughter. And yeah, I mean, lots of disasters between the two of them, and they relied on each other for that. There's a line, I think, that just Hardy reacted to Laurel, Laurel reacted to Hardy, and that sums up their relationship. And they had a great friendship as well, much closer probably than Jack and Neville. But that was secured on the tours. Back in Hollywood, it was just making movies, making business. Stan was that steered that, and Ollie was on the golf course. But when they toured, they always shared a dressing room. They liked to have hotel rooms next to each other, and their families got on really well. And that was the last 10 years, really.
And I think laughter builds trust. So Stan and Ollie, of course, comedy, and then they're laughing together. They built their trust together. Even in the Peace Chamberlain piece on the time, there's not a ton of laughter, but there are certain moments, a little light moments that you see that these two characters, you know, Chamberlain and Jack, they had that trust. And so I think that there is, I mean, it would be a very tenuous similarity, but, you know, that whole laughter and being honest with each other. Because, I mean, Stan and Ollie had to be honest with each other, and I think that same with Jack and Chamberlain.
Final question to both of you, and for both shows. How do you think, firstly, Laurel and Hardy would see the world of comedy today as it's evolved in the world of entertainment?
That's a very good question. Probably a bit too complicated for them, I think. They kept it really simple. Stan talks about regretting going into the longer feature films, although they had some huge success there. But for him, it was a simple scenario, a comedy situation, two gags at the most, maybe a song, but not always, and that was pretty much it. Ollie got into a mess because Stan did something wrong, and that was pretty much wherever you found them, whether they're in the Foreign Legion or in the Navy or down and out singing outside a shop. It was the same story, really, but just in different situations. I think they would be a bit phased and by the complications of modern comedy.
I think the interesting thing is, on our travels, and doing the Laurel and Hardy, as we did it last year and this year, it's interesting to see that their fan base is all over the world. And in fact, we were down in Dimchurch a few days ago doing Laurel and Hardy show, and they were talking about how, because they were, of course, they transferred from silent into speakies, and so there was that, but how that their comedy could just really cut through all these barriers. And so I think David's right. I totally agree. It would be too complicated now. Although to say that, Stan worked constantly on the art of comedy. I mean, you know, one of the things is he revered Chaplin. Chaplin was his marker. He felt he was never as good as Chaplin. So I think there was a lot of work at it's simple, and I think that's what it is. The simplicity is that it's very complicated, in the sense, but not with all the high-tech stuff. It was mainly the sight gags, of course, and then just the verbal side of things as well. So I think they would be taken aback a little bit with what goes on today, but, you know, I mean, their popularity just remains.
Yeah, but I think what is their affection and their friendship for each other is very strong. You see that, I guess, occasionally in the, I don't know, you know, Ant and Dec work really well together, but they've got a very strong friendship that they base that on, and not that they're film actors like Laurel and Hardy, but Laurel and Hardy's friendship was key to their success, I think.
And then, so part two of that question is, you know, in our day and age right now, we offer the keys to number 10 to Neville Chamberlain, and he faces the world now.
I think he'd struggle with the 24-hour media, Neville, to be honest. He wasn't. He talks a lot about loving checkers and being away at the weekend, and he would make that Friday afternoon to Monday afternoon if he could, because he was not a big fan of Whitehall, of Downing Street, of being in the public eye, and he thought, close the big gates of checkers, and he and his wife loved it there. So I'm not sure he's a PM of today, really.
So he might refuse the keys.
I don't know. I think he would, but reluctantly, because he... What we found also, I think your character talks about liking the praise of others. Yeah. So he liked the limelight a little bit when it happened, and the fact that Hitler invited him and he thought he'd got peace in our time and came back very proudly... He would have retired after that, I think, if that had stayed.
Yeah, one of the lines we say in the play is, he seeks the quiet life and yet hankered after the highest office in the land. Yeah. Quite a paradox. Right. And I think it's that whole dichotomy. Yeah, he probably loved it and then hated it as well. I think he would go. He might go reluctantly. Yeah. I mean, if he was... You know, they had a party leadership campaign and he was in there, he might be there. How long he'd want to be there, I'm not sure.
His predecessor, Baldwin, resigned fairly quickly after Edward VIII abdicated. So he wasn't really expecting to be PM. He reminds me a little bit of Sir John Major, that he just sort of stumbled into it, really.
Well, in a way, this is a period piece, but it does seem to speak to some of the issues today as well. So thank you very much for talking to Fringe Review.
Thank you so much. Thank you.